You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lee Chui Lin, joined today by Dr. Tara George, retinal specialist. And there is a lot of confusion surrounding eye health, and the information available doesn't always help. And Dr. Tara is going to attempt to clarify some of these issues surrounding retinal diseases. Dr. Tara, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lynn.
So I kind of, I wanted to do this show mostly because I have a lot of uncles, and over the weekend listening to them talk, I found that there was really just a lot of stuff that either they weren't sure about or that different doctors had told them different things. Do you find that in your experience there is a lot of confusion about eye health, especially amongst sort of the middle-aged?
Yes, because most people think the eye is just a small structure in our body, but actually the eye is composed of many parts, and we're talking about the anterior segment or the anterior part of the eye, which will be the cornea and the lens, and the posterior part of the eye, which would be the vitreous cavity and the retina. And in fact, even though it's such a small structure, we have doctors who are subspecialized in these different areas because there's much to do and there are many types of treatments that are specialized to these areas. So with all these knowledge and new treatments available, sometimes the patients do get a little confused on which part we're actually treating.
Okay. And how delicate is the retina? You're a retinal specialist.
Yes.
You know, why did you choose, firstly, to kind of subspecialize in retinas?
Okay, retina is actually, maybe I'm biased, but it's like the most important structure for us to see. Now, the front of the eye, the cornea and the lens are also equally important. They are the refracting surface. But there are treatments now to change the cornea, you know, called a corneal transplant. And if you have a cataract, you can remove the lens. But those kinds of conditions, treatments are still limited for the retina. And it's very important, therefore, to diagnose these conditions early and treat them early before any irreversible damage occurs. And if you catch them early, it's very rewarding when you treat these diseases.
Is the retina prone to disease and injury?
The retina is a very delicate structure, as you've mentioned, and there are many blood vessels at the back on the retina because it requires a lot of oxygen. So blood vessels bring with them chemical mediators. They are prone to damage when you have diseases in the body like diabetes, and therefore they are prone to diseases. The retina is prone to diseases. Now, in terms of injury, the eyeball, you know, is round, and it's like putting a tennis ball into a socket. So when you have an injury, especially indirect injury, like say someone, you're hit on the eye or someone punches you, or you have a sports injury, like a shuttlecock injury to the eye, the front of the eye is compressed, but the actual force is transmitted to the back of the eye, to the retina. And it's the periphery of the retina that develops tears and bleedings when you have this form of injury.
And what retinal, I guess, diseases or conditions do you see most often in your practice?
Well, here in Malaysia, I think the most common disease would be diabetic retinopathy, because diabetes is on the rise. Secondly, would be retinal vein blockage or retinal vein occlusion, which we would call as a mini stroke in the eye. And in my area, I do see a lot of patients with uveitis as well, because although rare, this is a condition that needs immediate attention and proper treatment.
Could you tell us more about what you were saying about that mini stroke in the eye? What was it called again?
Retinal vein occlusion.
And what happens in that situation?
Well, the circulation in the eye is impaired, and there are two vessels that cause circulation in the eye, your arteries and your veins. There's a central retinal vein that drains the blood out of the eye, and as well as the branches. Now, you can get occlusion in either the central vein or one of the branches. Basically, it means there's stagnation of blood flow in the eye. So the circulation is poor, and fluid and blood would ooze out of the blood vessels, causing edema of the retina, and that would cause poor vision. And this edema, if it's prolonged, as well as the blockage, if it's prolonged, it leads to lack of oxygen supply, or we call it ischemia, and that too can cause loss of vision and bleeding at the back of the eye.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Tara George, retinal specialist, and we're talking about retinal diseases in general with a slight focus on uveitis and diabetic retinopathy. If you've got any questions for Dr. Tara, we look forward to hearing from you. Do text us 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio. Okay, Dr. Tara, so we were talking about uveitis. You mentioned that it's rare. What can you tell us about it? What is it exactly?
Uveitis is actually inflammation in the eyeball itself. It can affect any part of the eyeball. If it's occurring in the front of the eye, we call it anterior uveitis. If it is occurring at the back of the eye, we call it posterior uveitis. Uvea is actually the structure that you see in the front of the eye, the dark colored structure, the iris. That's in the front. In the back of the eye, it's known as the choroid. So inflammation in any of these structures is known as uveitis. It may spill over into the cavity of the eye or even onto the coats of the eyes. So it's not confined to just one layer, but we broadly call it uveitis.
And is there a difference between anterior and posterior uveitis in terms of, I guess, in terms of how serious it can be or in terms of the discomfort it can cause somebody?
Yeah. Now, anything in the front of the eye, which is where the surface of the eye is, causes more symptoms. So it's more rapidly recognized. So anterior uveitis would present with a red eye, an inability to look at light. We call it photophobia. And the key symptom is, despite the eye being red, there will be no discharge, as opposed to someone who has a sore eye or conjunctivitis. With a red eye, they do have discharge. But in patients with uveitis occurring in the front of the eye, they're just very sensitive to light with a red eye. Now, those patients usually present much earlier because it troubles them. On the other hand, posterior uveitis occurs at the back of the eye, so the eye will not be red, but they may have symptoms like floaters or blurring. And this is a very broad symptom, so patients usually present a little later when they have posterior uveitis.
How common is this condition in Malaysia?
It's not common, but in my clinic, where I do see a lot of referrals, I may see about two to three patients a week. Majority are anterior uveitis and a few are posterior. Now, the reason why those patients with posterior uveitis are less is mainly because they present late.
Right.
As they go around and they are not aware of what's actually going on in the eye.
And what are some of the causes of uveitis?
Broadly, we could divide them into infections and inflammations. That means purely an autoimmune process going on in the eye. And very rarely, certain tumors in the eye can cause uveitis. Infections, I think I've talked about this before. It could be parasites like toxoplasma transmitted in the cats, or tuberculosis, and things like viruses, herpes viruses, chickenpox virus, can also affect the retina. Why it's important to differentiate these causes is because the treatment varies in the different types of uveitis.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to it being sort of a response by the body, what kind of damage can white blood cells cause in the eye, especially when it's sort of when it stems from an autoimmune disorder, for example?
Okay, now the eye is very special because white blood cells are supposed to be the soldiers of your body. They're supposed to attack and kill any foreign objects or germs. But when the fight occurs, when they're trying to do that, there's a lot of chemicals released and swelling and mediators that are released. And in the eye, these mediators actually damage the delicate structures of the eye, like the retina and the lens and even the front of the eye. So we want to, number one, treat the cause, which if it's an infection, we need to treat the infection. And number two, we need to minimize the damage from these white blood cells. So we actually have to suppress them a little while they're trying to attack these organisms. So we give patients both antibiotics and a little bit of steroids as well to suppress the inflammation.
Okay. And I've read that an urgent referral to an ophthalmologist is required to diagnose uveitis. What are the initial symptoms that a GP would need in order to say, okay, I need to send you on to a specialist?
Okay, so for anterior uveitis, the eye would be red.
Correct.
And that's quite obvious. But a red eye has many causes. And the first clue, as I've mentioned, is if there's no discharge and the eye is red, that's a warning sign. And secondly is if there's blurring of vision. In a normal sore eye, your vision should not be blurred. It just be red eye with discharge. So if there's blurring of vision and no discharge with a red eye, it alerts the GP to refer the patient to an eye specialist.
And how would an ophthalmologist then diagnose uveitis?
We need to do an examination on a special device called a slit lamp. It's actually a microscope that enables us to look into the eye. So with this device, we can actually look into the eye and see these white blood cells. There are different types of white blood cells. There can be large ones or small ones. And you can also see the changes, not only in the front, but also the back of the eye. And once we see these cells in the eye, we diagnose uveitis.
Okay, I'm speaking to Dr. Tara George today, retinal specialist, and we're discussing retinal diseases as a whole. We've been focusing on uveitis. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about diabetic retinopathy. We look forward to your questions. Do text us 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
You're listening to BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Bigger Picture with me, Lee Chui Lin, and Dr. Tara George, retinal specialist. We're discussing retinal diseases, and we've been talking about uveitis. So you mentioned earlier that you might need to treat somebody with both antibiotics and steroids. Is that the general course of treatment for uveitis?
That's if it's an infective cause.
Right.
Now, if it's a non-infective cause, we've done all the tests and we find that there's no particular cause for this condition. We know it's an autoimmune condition. The immune system is attacking the eye. This can happen in other parts of the body as well, but in the eye, it's seen as uveitis. So if it's just occurring in the front of the eye, we give steroid eye drops because that is sufficient to treat the front of the eye. But if it's occurring at the back of the eye, the patient may need other forms of treatment, either tablet steroids, or sometimes we even give injections of steroids around the eye to treat this condition.
And how long does a treatment course usually last?
For most of the uveitis affecting the back of the eye, the minimum duration of treatment would be 6 months. So that's a message I do give the patients from the start, because if you're expecting a miracle cure, you would be disappointed. Most of them need at least 6 months of treatment.
Are there any alternatives that are available to steroids? Because some patients, you know, to this day, do feel uncomfortable with the usage of it, perhaps due to misinformation or, you know, just allergies.
No, steroid itself is a drug with side effects. So I do understand that a lot of patients are worried about using steroids. In fact, we as doctors are worried too sometimes. So patients who have diabetes or high blood pressure, in those cases, the steroids may aggravate these conditions and we opt to use other agents. We call them steroid sparing agents. The other group of patients would be teenagers or children in the growing age group, because steroids actually may stunt their growth. So we offer steroid sparing agents. And of course, people who develop side effects while on the steroids, they may get a very bad gastritis or put on a lot of weight, and we need to alter the medication, and we try to avoid using steroids in these patients.
Okay, we've got a question from George who says, my late father and I had blue halo around the corneas and we both have high glucose that are above parameters. I suppose he's asking what that blue halo might indicate.
Okay, the region of our eyeball should be normally white in color. Sometimes you can get a bluish tinge to that area. There are many reasons. One of them is a condition where you may have had inflammation of the white coat of the eye called the sclera, and it thins after some time and you actually get a bluish tinge, which is a reflection of the underlying structures. Another condition is a very rare congenital condition, osteogenesis, where you get a blue sclera, we call it, but that would present with a lot of other malformations as well. So it's very unlikely to be that.
All right. So is there anything that he needs to be worried about?
No, if the eye is white, there's no pain and it's just a color change. It's nothing to worry about.
Okay. And going back to uveitis, are there any potential long-term side effects? Because, you know, even hearing that the course of treatment takes 6 months is worrying to some people, worrying to me.
Yeah. The message is that uveitis, if untreated, can cause more problems. So the treatment, the side effects from the treatment are minimal compared to the side effects from the disease itself. Now, the disease, if untreated, could lead to cataract formations much faster than just by using steroids. Can also lead to glaucoma and even sometimes retinal detachments or membranes on the retina that may need surgery. And once the retina or these structures are damaged, sometimes we can't reverse it. And that's why we need to initiate treatment and be aggressive from the start.
We have got another text question who, and this person asks, is there any cure for degeneration of the retina?
Degeneration of the retina, there is a broad term. The one that we most commonly see is age-related macular degeneration happening in the elderly. Unfortunately, to this date, there's no cure for this condition. All treatments that are available slow down or retard the process that's occurring. There are studies going on, especially on the genetic basis, to see whether gene therapy and stem cell can help to reverse the changes. But a cure as such is not seen yet.
All right. We are looking forward to more questions from you. 016-201-9000 is the number to text, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, Dr. Tara, you mentioned earlier that floaters yes. Are something that, you know, it's something of a general symptom.
Yes.
Could you tell us what floaters are? I mean, we've covered the show with yes. another ophthalmologist, Dr. Kenneth Fong, before, yes. but, you know, from a general point of view.
Floaters basically are anything in the cavity of your eye that cast a shadow on your retina and give you an impression of something floating in the eye. It could be the normal structure in your jelly of the eye, which are actually collagen fibrils in the vitreous gel of your eye. That is a normal floater that a lot of people may experience, one or two floaters when they look ahead. The second one could be just a sudden shower of floaters, which could be bleeding in the eye. And these floaters are usually slightly larger and darker. You also have floaters from white blood cells in the back of the eye. These are tiny specks that move around. And after you have an injury, of course, that'll be very obvious. You may suddenly have a shower of floaters. This also could be due to blood. Very rarely, as people get older, you can get calcium floating in the vitreous cavity, and this may also give the sensation of having a floater.
And when are floaters indicative of a serious retinal issue?
If the eye is red with a floaters, that's definitely something going on. If the vision starts getting blurry with a floaters, that's also something serious going on. Most likely that's a bleed. And if you have floaters with associated flashes of lightning in the eye, which indicates that something is tugging on your retina, which may predispose you to a retinal tear, if one not already is there, these are sinister symptoms.
And that's when you would need to... So in those situations... where should a person go? Should they go to their GP or an emergency room or to an ophthalmologist?
I think if you have a sudden floater with blurring or any of the flashes, it's better to go directly to an ophthalmologist. The reason being, conditions like retinal detachment might present with this, and retinal detachment is actually an emergency, and it's better to go directly to the eye specialist because they could pick it up straight away.
We have a question here from Linda who asks whether hyperthyroidism can affect the retinas, and if so, how do we treat it?
Hyperthyroidism can actually affect the structures around the eyeball. We call it the orbit. So it doesn't directly affect the retina. But when the structures are swollen, the muscles and the soft tissue around the orbit are swollen, they actually compress on the back of the eyeball. They may compress the optic nerve, and then one may lose vision from that. So if a person has hyperthyroidism, usually we do ask them to have an eye examination at least once a year or once in 6 months. However, if the eye is red or what we call proptosis, bulging forward, then they need to come for the examination even earlier.
And someone else asks, in Chinese medicine, eyes are the windows of the liver. How does Western medicine look at this?
From terms of Western medicine, we would say eyes and the kidney share the same structure.
Is that right?
Yes. So by looking into the eye, in diabetes especially, if the damage is seen in the eye, we do know the damage is seen in the kidney as well, because they share the similar blood vessels. But we haven't really heard about the liver in the retinal blood vessels. There are other parts of the eye that show diseases that are happening in the liver, something like Wilson's disease. We look for a sign in the front of the eye that shows us this patient has this condition.
Okay. And someone else asks, I would like to find out if LASIK laser treatment for short sight has a long-term side effect. What are the risks involved in the treatment?
I can answer this question in general, okay, because LASIK is not a custom procedure for everyone. So there's no standard answer. However, before you have LASIK, the doctor has to assess for your pupil size, for whether you have dry eyes, because all this can sometimes affect the outcome of the LASIK procedure. The doctor will also measure the thickness of your cornea, because they're actually thinning out your cornea when they're doing LASIK, to decide whether you are a suitable candidate. Now, most patients who have LASIK are short-sighted, so they are have thin retinas, because their eyeball is long, they have thin retinas. So although you have the LASIK and you correct and you don't need to wear glasses, you're actually still having a long eyeball. So you're still prone to retinal tears and all the problems that short-sighted people have. So before having the LASIK, it's necessary to have a retinal examination to make sure that any holes or tears are treated prior to the LASIK.
Right, but there are no risks intrinsic to the person per se.
In general, there are risks for any procedure, which the doctor, I think, will explain in great detail. And only once the patient understands that will they have the procedure. There are risks to the front of the eye, the cornea, but not really long term. It's more of short term. If the complication occurs, you'll see it quite fast.
And Jay asks, I have had keratoconus since I was 24. Now I'm 28. I have had cross-linking, but only stabilized in one eye, and I wear Rose K lenses. Any alternative to the lenses besides surgery? Will it progress over age? And diabetes runs in my family, so are there any complications?
Okay. Diabetes and keratoconus are not related, so they're two separate issues. Keratoconus is a progressive thinning of the cornea, and cross-linking is one of the new treatments that are available, and she has already had that done. Unfortunately, as you've mentioned, it does not work 100% and it does not last for a long time, but it is a temporary measure to slow down the thinning of the cornea. Eventually, if the cornea progressively thins and contact lenses are not suitable, there are procedures, corneal surgeries, to reverse this thinning of the cornea. It's actually types of corneal grafts. There are different types of corneal grafts now where we don't have to take the whole cornea and transplant it. We can just transplant certain layers of the cornea, and this would be beneficial if the condition progresses.
Right. At what point would you recommend that surgery be done?
That if she's intolerant to contact lenses, and she also needs to seek an opinion from a corneal specialist. These are subspecialized areas which need to be treated by a corneal specialist.
All right. And moving on quickly to diabetic retinopathy, since, as you say, it is the most common thing that you see in your clinic. So what is the relation? What happens, you know, with diabetes and the eyes?
Diabetes is basically high blood sugar. We all know that. The high blood sugar over the years causes changes in the structure of the blood vessels, especially in the small blood vessels of the eye called the capillaries, the venules and the arterioles. These blood vessels actually sometimes get blocked, or they even get leaky. So these two changes happen, and when they get blocked, the oxygen supply is reduced. When they get leaky, whatever contents that are lying inside the blood vessels leak out, and that causes swelling. And these are the two changes that causes problems in vision.
We're still receiving questions from you. If you would like to text 016-201-9000 for any questions you might have about retinal diseases or diabetic retinopathy, or you can tweet BFM Radio. Jay has just SMS to say, thanks, by the way, I'm a guy.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Thank you for the clarification. Okay, so going back to diabetic retinopathy, retinopathy itself is classified into a number of different stages. Could you describe them?
retinopathy could be, basically the thing is we don't want new blood vessels to grow on the retina. Once new blood vessels start growing, it's called proliferative diabetic retinopathy. Any other stage where the new blood vessels are not growing are called non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy. We monitor patients from the stage where they have non-proliferative retinopathy, and if there are any signs that they are moving on towards proliferative retinopathy, we need to institute treatment. The other thing is macular edema, or swelling of the center of the macula, which also causes loss of vision, and we grade that as well. And if the swelling occurs right in the center, then patients need intervention.
Can this disease progress without getting noticed?
In the early stages, there are actually no symptoms. Actually, even in the advanced stages where there's proliferative retinopathy, if those abnormal blood vessels are not occurring anywhere near the center of the retina, the patient may have perfect 6/6 vision without any symptoms until it's too late.
So at what point do most patients, you know, start to realize that this is an issue?
Well, I would hope that most of them realize that on their own, but that's rarely the case. In fact, we did a study in the Diabetic Eye Registry in 2007 where 70% of people actually never have had eye checkups. So people present once they've had floaters or blurring, which is a stage that the disease is already quite advanced. We can still institute treatment, but the outcome would be better if they had presented earlier.
Okay, and does one develop diabetic retinopathy purely as a result of diabetes, or are there other causes?
There are other risk factors that can accelerate diabetic retinopathy. Firstly, would be things like smoking. Smoking also occludes your blood vessels. Secondly, would be pregnancy. We see younger people getting diabetes now. And I'm not talking about diabetes that only occurs during pregnancy. These are people who are already diabetic who get pregnant. And during this period, the retinopathy actually accelerates rapidly because of the hormonal changes. The other thing would be uncontrolled hypertension and uncontrolled cholesterol and lipids. These also cause changes in the blood vessels that accelerate retinopathy.
And amongst diabetic patients, as a demographic, as a group, how common is retinopathy?
If you have diabetes for 15 years, 90% of the time there are changes in your retina. But if your diabetes is well controlled, these changes would be mild and will not affect your vision.
Okay, so this is something that is perhaps more long-term then. It is not an immediate change.
Long-term if you've had good control, but it can be short-term if you've had bad control. A lot of people are unaware that they've had diabetes, and at the time of diagnosis, they may have already had it for 2 or 3 years and it had been left untreated. So we have patients presenting to us at the time of diagnosis with changes in the eye already because they would not have been aware that they've had diabetes for 2 or 3 years.
Of course. And someone is asking us, do we have stem cell implants for retinitis pigmentosa here in Malaysia?
No, we don't have stem cell implants actually anywhere in the world for retinitis pigmentosa. Stem cell therapy is under research and it's being done in the US. It has shown some promising results, but it still hasn't been done on the humans yet. For retinitis pigmentosa, we have retinal implants, which are actually devices that help a person who's completely blind to see. They are microchips that are implanted into the retina to help these people to see. But these are people who are completely blind prior to having this implant done for them.
Okay, and does it seem likely that stem cells will be a treatment in time to come?
Yes, stem cells will be helpful once the disease has occurred to help regenerate the retina, and that's something that's being done on the way. But actually more progress has been done in gene therapy. There are certain types of retinitis pigmentosa where the gene has been identified, and if you have a family history when the child is born, you can do genetic testing, and if that gene is present, gene therapy can be instituted for this form of retinal dystrophy.
Fantastic. And moving back to diabetic retinopathy, so it's becoming very clear that it is a problem, and it's a problem that often goes unnoticed. So what are some symptoms that indicate that a diabetic patient needs to go to an ophthalmologist now?
Okay. Urgent. They need to go urgently if you have a shower of floaters. Okay, that indicates bleeding in the eye. Secondly, if you look at things and they appear distorted or blurry, and it's very important to check one eye at a time. A lot of patients present late because one eye might be fine and they never realize that there's a problem in the other. So they present quite late. So be aware of visual symptoms. And if you're a diabetic, take extra care and do your eye checkup regularly. Usually we recommend it at least once a year.
In Malaysia, the average age of diagnosis is 45 years and decreasing.
Yes.
What have been your observations that have led to this? You mentioned earlier pregnancy.
Yes.
What else?
You know, there's this National Health and Morbidity Survey they did in 2006, which found that 14% of people above 35 are diabetic. So it's no more 45. It's gone down to 35.
And it's a whole decade.
Yes. And that was a double. It was 8% in 1996. So it's almost double in 10 years. And I see it even increasing now. We've had teenagers who are 19 and in their 20s who come in with changes in the eye due to diabetes. And this is in fact quite sad because they would not have recognized that they've had this problem. And it's mainly lifestyle and obesity and things that like that that are on the rise.
Mm-hmm. We have a question here that's very good, albeit very sort of, we take it for granted that everybody would know this, but should we have regular eye checkups? And if so, how often and from what age? And I think here the question is not so much whether or not we should be checking on our power for our glasses,
yes,
but,
yes.
You know, a complete eye checkup.
Yes, that's an interesting point because a lot of Malaysians feel that going to the optician encompasses an eye checkup.
Yes.
But it's much more than that. An eye checkup involves checking your eye pressure, looking into the retina and using the slit lamp to look at the eye. Now, we recommend an eye checkup at least when you're above 18 once, and above 40 you should have it done at least once in 5 years if you have no problems. If you have a family history of glaucoma, at least once in 2 years, or if necessary, once a year if your doctor says so. If you have diabetes, of course, you have to have it once a year. If you've got a family history of retinal detachment, once a year, once in 2 years. So above 40, you need to have regular checkups.
It increases.
Yes. And definitely above 18, you need to have at least one eye checkup. Don't wait till we're 40.
Okay. And what about if you have a family history of cataracts?
Okay, family history of cataracts, it depends what type of cataracts. Now, if you it's a family history of senile cataracts, which usually happen in people above 60, that's a normal process of aging. That is nothing to do with hereditary factors. However, if you have a family history of cataracts occurring at a young age, like someone in their 40s has a cataract, then you need to go for an eye checkup earlier because that there could be a hereditary component.
Okay. What treatment options are available for patients of diabetic retinopathy? Does it correspond with the medication that they would already be taking for their diabetes, or is it a whole separate set?
It's a whole separate set. The control of diabetes is important, and that usually the physician takes care of it and they do a good job, but the eye is a whole separate issue. Number one, if there's swelling, we would like to reduce the swelling in the eye because when the swelling comes down, the vision will improve. There are different ways to reduce the swelling in the eye, and currently there are different types of injections that are injected into the eye to reduce the swelling. Unfortunately, all these treatments are not permanent cures, and what we do is try and reduce the swelling until the body stabilizes. Now, the damage in the retina would not have happened overnight. It may have taken a minimum of 2 years or so for the changes to occur. So even if the physician controls the blood sugar well, for the eye to stabilize, it may take another 2 years. So during that period, we have to be vigilant in the eye treatment.
And for patients of, you know, uveitis and diabetic retinopathy and perhaps, you know, retinal diseases in general, What kind of lifestyle changes do they need to make, you know, in order to sort of preserve their eye health?
I think for patients with diabetes, of course, it's a control of diabetes and a whole lifestyle change. Diabetes is a disease of the lifestyle, and starting from food, exercise, and taking your medication and things like that, that would help the eyes as well. Now, in terms of uveitis, it would be the types of medication that the person is taking. If they are on immunosuppressive medications, okay, things like steroids and medications that control the uveitis, they are more prone to develop infections. So we usually advise them to avoid visiting people who are sick, especially very contagious diseases like tuberculosis, chickenpox, things like that. Because if they develop an infection, they would develop a more aggressive form of infection as opposed to other people. So during the period while they're on this treatment, we do advise them to take extra care of their hygiene and avoid these kind of situations.
And finally, what message would you like to leave us with, you know, on the subject of our retinal health? Because it's something I think many of us don't think about when we think about having to go for checkups, thinking about preserving our health.
I think the most important thing would be to be aware of our visual symptoms and to check each eye at a time. The retina, one eye might be having some damage, the other eye might be normal. And unless we actually shut one eye, with, you know, simple way, you just close it with your hand and check each eye at a time, only then will we be aware of these symptoms. And any visual symptom should be taken seriously and just get a checkup. Once you've had a checkup, then you're assured that things are fine.
Thank you, Dr. Tara. I've been speaking today to Dr. Tara George, retinal specialist, and we've been discussing retinal diseases on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.